Welcome, everyone, to the Healing Power of Plants. I'm Lauren Almquist, founder of Heartspace Herbals and Garden Design, and I am so excited for this conversation today with Jade Alicandro. Jade weaves a love of the bioregionally abundant herbs and kitchen medicine to her work as a community and clinical herbalist. You can often find her roaming the hedges with her harvest basket in hand or at home in the kitchen, brewing up some potent food as medicine. She offers in-person apprenticeships, workshops and plant walks, online classes, virtual wellness consultations, and hosts an online membership program on Patreon. Welcome, Jade, to the conversation. I'm super excited to dig in.
Thanks, Lauren, for having me.
So, this is a big topic. We're going to talk about connecting with the land through plants, through quote, invasive plants. Quotes are very important, but well, before we dive in, actually, I would love to start with just a little bit about yourself. Anything you want to add about either how you came to your plant journey or anything that you're doing currently that you're really excited about?
Yeah, I mean the sort of nutshell version is I came to herbalism through the plants, but more through plant biology and plant ecology. Studying plant bio in college and then ending up doing a bunch of work for the Forest Service with plant identification, basically being like a botany tech. And that is kind of what led me into the world of herbalism, because it really wasn't a part of my awareness as a kid. And it was like I was on the edge of that in college and then working with the plants. Right at that ground level, right in the ecosystems as my job, it's what kind of opened me up to the larger conversation around these plants being medicinal. And it really just took off from there. That was like my early 20s. And after doing that for a few years and then kind of doing like the woofing around, at different farms, that program where you volunteer in different farms, I got more experience with plants doing that. I met nettles for the first time in the cloud forest of Ecuador, which was
Wow.
just wild. And it really, and then I really, kind of hit a new point in my path where it was sort of like, well, you could keep doing the traveling, bouncing around thing, or you could settle down and like go to herb school. And so that's what I did. I came back to where I still live now, Western Mass, which is where I'm from originally. It's where I went to college. So I had a great community here. And there's a bunch of herb schools here. So that's, and then that was probably the early 2000s. And I just studied with every herbalist I could kind of get my hands on in the Northeast and during that time. And, I don't know, what are we now? We're almost 20 years later. So here we
Wow.
are. But that's kind of that, in a nutshell, kind of what got
Yeah.
me on the plant path. It was always a love for ecology and nature that then opened up and expanded into the medicinal aspects.
Amazing. And you've run your own apprenticeship program now, or do you still run that now?
Yeah, I do. Yep. So I run an apprenticeship in bioregional herbalism. It's called From the Roots Up, and it just has grown and grown. It started off as like a seasonal class series that was like once a month each season. And it was kind of like a la carte. Like you could pick, do you want to do the spring, the fall, the summer? But then enough people wanted to do all of the sessions that it sort of was like, well, let me offer this as a full year program. And then so for a while, I did those two things adjacently. And then I think last year was the first year, just from again, like really my business has always been very like just responsive to like what my community and people are asking for. So after a long time of people asking, I added a year too. And but to kind of accomplish that, I needed to prune back those seasonal sessions. So any business owner knows you have to do the pruning, which isn't always easy. But so now I run 2 year one programs, like two different sessions, just because there was enough interest. And I added this year too. And really, they just meet like once a month through the growing season, all outside, all on local farms. And the real emphasis is on meeting our locally, bioregionally abundant plants in person and getting to know them and harvesting and ecology and making medicine. And yeah, so those are in person offerings. And then I do a bunch of online stuff too. So.
Beautiful, beautiful. And just quickly for people that don't know, you mentioned woofing, and I know what it is, but could you remind us what it's
Well, I
world?
think woofing, I think it's two W's, and I think, isn't it like worldwide workers on organic farms?
Something like that. That works, yeah.
It's basically, I feel like it was such a like 90s, early 2000 thing. I don't know if people still do it, but it was like this database. It was like the early days of the internet, right? And it
Yeah.
was like, yeah, like this database where farms would create listings for themselves, different countries, and you, it's a work trade model. So you go and you work on these farms in exchange for food, housing, and you know, ideally the best farms like some level of education. You know,
Okay.
so that's what I was doing in South America and Central America in the
Amazing.
early 2000s for a minute. So
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you for sharing that. And there's so much here, but I wonder if like I imagine that some people might have knowledge of what is thought of as a native plant or non-native, but I'd love for you to just say your take on or define when we're talking about a native plant versus a non-native plant, and then we can get into quote unquote invasives and bioregionally abundant plants.
yeah, I mean, this is a super interesting question because there's no worldwide scientific consensus on what even constitutes a native plant versus a non-native. So I think right there, that's just an awesome entry point into the conversation. You know, so it'll depend on the country, the region, you know, whoever who you're asking, and really, it's because that's just an incredibly difficult question to answer. It gets into shades of gray, you know, it gets into some subjectivity. So, you know, often a native plant will be discussed as in, you know, either you have evidence from the fossil record that it's been there for a su super long time. That's possible sometimes, but it really depends on the region. Like, we can't really use the fossil record in the Northeast as well because our plants, so something that many people aren't aware of is the Northeast was glaciated up until probably like 12,000 years ago, or and my numbers are going to be like, there might be like 2,000 to 3,000 years with that in either direction. But somewhere between like 12 and 8,000 years ago, that the Laurentide ice sheet receded completely. And so this whole region, and it went pretty far south, it went into the Midwest, was glaciated. And during the last ice age. And during that time, that ice sheet was apparently like the biggest on Earth. It was a massive ice sheet and upwards of 2 miles thick in some places. Yeah. And when it melted, it raised the entire sea level, like of the world. So as that receded, which I believe was somewhere between like, yeah, like 10 to 8,000 years ago, there were no plants here from what we know. You know, it was because it, as it receded, it scraped the land. And in some places, I mean, it was a whole thing. Some places it deposited glacial till, some places it scraped the earth. I mean, it did all different things. Created Cape Cod. You know, it's a very obvious example of how glaciation affected the landscape in the Connecticut River Valley. But at first, it was just tundra because it was, you know, still very cold and still very north. And then it slowly, over thousands of years, became the taiga, which is like a, you know, a northern forest. And then the forests we see here now are like 3,000 years old, which, if you actually think about on a geologic time scale, are they're babies. They're baby forests, you know? And so that's something to really think about is like all the plants we would consider to be native here have really only been here for like 3,000 years, potentially. There may have been some in the seed bed, you know, from before the glaciation, but again, like most of the plants kind of crept back north from the south. That's more of what happened. Or from other areas that weren't glaciated, maybe some crept south from the north, you know, but areas that weren't glaciated that provided those plants for the most part to come back. So when we talk about what's native, it's like, well, first of all, it's a pretty t small time period. So that's one thing that I just always want to bring into this conversation is just geologic timescale and understanding that nothing about what we're seeing is static. Nature is dynamic and it's always changing. So anytime we try to apply this like freeze frame timestamp on the landscape, we've already lost science. Like it's already gone, you know, because that's not how plants work. And so there are different, so that's one way of sort of thinking about native plants. Another is just like, it's just been here for as long as anyone can remember, And we definitely have, in terms of written record, not that long, but of course we have like indigenous records and, that way of keeping time, and that is its own version of science, absolutely. So it's not the easiest question to answer.
But I said that you're right. It's such a great discussion point to start because I think in the, people talk about or people talk about it like it is a fixed thing. And just if people don't know, if you get into the internet, like people have very strong opinions about these topics and about what is native, what is non-native, what's in quote unquote invasive. But yeah, so thank you for that perspective. So if someone is like wondering, like is if they come across a plant and they're wondering, is this native or not native? I mean, how do you have a recommendation of how someone would even find that out? Or is it more kind of seeing what's around you and then like going from there and like learning, just learning about the plants and seeing where that history takes you?
Yeah, no, I think it's a combination of both. So there are actual, like, quote unquote invasive, and you're all are seeing us use the quote unquote invasive because it's not, I won't use that every time, but honestly, when I say invasive, like for me, it's like I don't really fully prescribe to that
Sure.
language. But I understand that it's what's used and what many people colloquially know what, or have an idea of what that means. But as we're talking about, what does it actually mean? So you can look at like state invasive plant species lists and see, that's one way of doing it. However, it's really important to understand that the way that invasive plants are defined is incredibly subjective again. So like the National Invasive Plant Species Council, I have like their definition just to read. It's just like a sentence. They say it's an alien species whose introduction is likely to cause economic or environmental harm or harm to human health. So right there, the massive red flag to me is economic harm, right? Because that has nothing to do, what does that mean? If it's a plant that's like the best example I can give for that being used in a detrimental way is actually out west. There's a pretty big ongoing kind of conversation, and in some ways battle against a native ecosystem, which is the juniper sagebrush ecosystem. This is considered to be native, fossil record, et cetera, et cetera. It's been there for thousands of years. And there is a organized campaign against its existence because it is creeping into range, like rangeland, that ranchers are using for their cattle to graze because animals don't like to eat juniper. And sagebrush is also a pretty intense plant for browsers. They want grass. So that ecosystem, so juniper sagebrush is actually getting labeled and is designated in some areas and states as invasive, but these are native plants. Right. So this definition right here is already giving room to call really any plant that is kind of annoying or not behaving according to capitalism, invasive. So it's incredibly problematic. And in fact, I see it in books. I've seen it in foraging books. I've seen, and depends on the author, right? But I've seen people call poke root invasive. That's a native plant. It's an early successional plant. And yeah, it's weedy, but that's what early successional plants do, right? If we understand what the landscape does, succession is, basically it happens in your garden. It's what you're fighting in your garden. It's like you turn over soil, little weeds germinate. That's the first stage of succession. And if you were to leave it over time, it could become a forest in the Northeast. That's, going from field to shrub land to forest. That's the simplest example of succession. So it's subjective, but another way that you'll hear people, I've heard invasion ecologists answer that question before as well, if it acts like an invasive, which again is like very subjective because most of our early successional plants act quote unquote invasive. And also what's very interesting and perhaps not at all a surprise if you understand plant ecology is that most of our non-native plants that are considered invasive are early successional plants in their own, native landscapes. They just do well and thrive with the disturbance that humans are so good at creating. And this is kind of one of the things to think about is like, is this just a symptom? Are they the problem or the symptom? And if they're the symptom, then why are we, applying chemicals that, get into the water table and are linked to all these health issues as restoration? It's a big question I have for the whole, the whole thing. I think one other thing, I'm trying to just look at my notes, see if there's anything that I was missing. I guess two other things I would just say about that is we do 100% have cases where a plant has been considered invasive somewhere and then someone finds it in the fossil record. This has happened for sure. And then they're like, oh, after you're applying Roundup to waterways for years as policy against a plant, that then they find out, oh, oops, it's been here. Been here. It's, it could be as simple as sometimes they're using notes from like, colonists and even conquistadors, like to decide if a plant has been here or not, like really kind of odd source material. And then another example of that too, a good plant that does this, that it's sort of like, in some places considered native, some place that it isn't, is purple loosestrife, which is a great example for the Northeast. So purple loosestrife, gorgeous, beautiful flower that is really well known in the waterways here. And it's considered right now like a top level invasive in Massachusetts for sure. They've brought in beetles to control it, all this stuff. Well, purple loosestrife is considered native to Eurasia. So Europe, Asia, the Mediterranean, but guess where else? And this is a kind of super random. Australia. It's considered native in Australia. And there is what is known as an extant population. So extant population means a population of plants somewhere that you might not expect it to be. And we even have this in America where it's believed that like certain food plants were moved around by different indigenous peoples. And it's like, oh, this is way out of its range. Like we have examples of this of camas in the Southeast, camas lily. And they're like, well, it's not its native range, but it must have been brought here at some point for food. So there is a question with the purple loosestrife, but it's considered native in Australia. So that's interesting. Whereas in the Northeast, when like colonists came, there is actually, so again, like, it's a weird source material, but it's interesting to think about. There are some writings of people, colonists, when they came here, talking about the purple loosestrife being, saying that it's so abundant when they got here, actually, that there is debate, and it's you wouldn't know it if you hopped on the Massachusetts Invasive Plant Species list, but there's debate actually as to whether purple loosestrife is or isn't native, and it could be one of these
Interesting.
plants that moves around really easily, or it could have being moved around by indigenous peoples for medicine and food. It's a powerful medicinal. So it's not simple. And these are all little examples just to sort of throw out there, just to kind of like get people's mind turning. Because that's where I'm coming from with all of this. That's something I really want to frame this conversation is I don't feel dogmatic about any of this. I just have curiosities and questions. And I, unfortunately, the larger conversation around invasive plants is incredibly toxic, and it's just sort of like either you agree that these are the most egregious thing that's ever happened to nature, or you're like a charlatan. And that's, that in and of itself, that speaks for itself, in my opinion, of like that, so I don't even try to engage in those conversations anymore. But I'd rather just ask some questions and maybe we can think about some other ways of thinking about this.
So well said, and I think, that we could apply that to not just plants, but a lot of things, but it's really important, and I'm so glad that you bring that up. And that's been a thread throughout all these conversations throughout this series is curiosity, being present. And so as you're talking, and thank you for those examples, because I think they make really clear like that it's not cut and dry, it's not good, bad. It reminds me a little bit of the question of like, in the garden, like, is this a weed? Is this good or bad? It's like, okay, let's
Super
like,
hard to answer that.
it's really hard to answer that. And there's tons of science and interesting things to follow, but like I just really appreciate your call to be curious and know that depends on the source. Like there are some very the language that we use as well can be harsh or not helpful. So as you're talking, I'm thinking about being present and observing and being curious about your environment. So I'd love if you would talk a little bit about one or two plants that you love to work with and its behavior in the environment. Because also, as you were talking, the other thing I was picking up on is observing the behavior of the plant in the environment where you are. So I'd love if you would talk a little bit about that, maybe use an example.
Totally. So, I mean, I think the plant that like called me into all of this was wild rose, Rosa multiflora. And, you know, I was mentioning I come from a background of plant ecology. I did, you know, a pretty big research project at UMass. I went to UMass Amherst. I remember my study was looking at glossy buckthorn, which is you know, definitely considered invasive in Massachusetts, and I've certainly spent time pulling it out of places, you know, including my own yard. So that's the other way to, like, in terms of like not being dogmatic, like it's like, yeah, there, it's like weeding kind of, or wild tending. It's a version of wild tending, you know. And it's like, so I don't really, I'm not here to make judgments on decisions to remove a plant from a certain place necessarily, although I do feel judgmental about glyphosate Roundup. That I do feel judgmental about. I will be honest about that. I don't think there's ever a time or a place to be applying that chemical in the name of the planet. That is cuckoo to me. Like, I'm just like, let's just back up for a minute, you know, and really think about that. But manual removal and things like that, sure. If needed, but that was like my research project was watching and charting its movement into a forest. And so it's, I think for me, I was able to sort of like extricate myself out of a certain narrative that just said, you know, it's an all or nothing conversation. And because what I started to notice is like, whoa, this forest has had incredible amounts of disturbance and there's like no understory. And this is like not even really like a healthy forest anyway. And healthy, that's subjective, but like, you know, it wasn't some like perfect, intact piece of old growth forest. You know, it was clearly had been logged in the, you know, or disturbed in the not too distant past. And those are skills you learn just by observing the landscape over time. But I saw that with wild rose too, you know, that it was always along the edges where the forest met the field in these places that were heavily, heavily disturbed. And then it sort of started to invite me into, as I got more into bioregional herbalism in like the early to mid 2000s, you know, I was like, because no one around me had been talking about that plant as being medicinal. And I, like, you know, I remember like sticking my face in that rose one day, because it was like, because it's a weird thing happens to people where if something gets labeled invasive in their head, there's like this button turns off. Yeah, you've probably seen it. It's like real. This is a real phenomenon. And like, for all intents and purposes, there is zero value to that plant, like zero value for humans, for the land, for the plant, for the animals. And so, like, I had to extricate myself out of that. I had that programming as well. And I remember sticking my face in that rose and being like, you know, in bloom, like, this is the most aromatic rose I've like ever smelled in my life. Like, in a simple organoleptic assessment, right, which we love in herbalism, using your senses to determine some sort of levels of medicinal quality with the plant. I was like, this is wow, you know. And I remember I like made a cordial with it and a tea, and I was just like, I'm so relaxed right now. I was like, this is super medicinal. Why are we just ignoring this rose that is like everywhere, you know? And so that was what invited me into it, just like the gift of these plants. And then I've since done a lot of observing of different plants all over. And, you know, and again, it kind of gets down to that question, like, wild rose will move into forests, like it will, but it generally doesn't love the shade, so it won't get to the same like robust level that it will along an edge. And if you're looking at, you know, a field, a forest, and the edge, where the rose tends to be is right in that edge, and it might be going a little bit into the forest, but not much, you know. So that's like an example of looking. And I may have lost the thread for the rest of your question. So if you want to.
Because we were talking about Rose. No, I mean that's such a perfect example. It was just like, what are some of your favorites? And like, how did you observe it? kind of behaving in the landscape. What's your experience with Japanese knotweed?
Yeah, I mean, well, knotweed. So again, I knotweed is an interesting one because it will spread from disturbance, or like it likes disturbed areas, but it does also have the capacity if like a bit of the root is broken off and it likes to go along waterways, that it can then like wash up and end up in a very intact native plant, ecosystem, or that's not the word I'm looking for, habitat, And so when that happens, for sure, like that's when I feel when my heart hurts and I'm like, oh wow, look at the ramps and the ostrich fern and the knotweed is kind of, And so that's an example of a place where I'm like, if you can catch it early enough, it's not a bad idea to try to do a little bit of removal, but it's also generally a fool's errand too. So sometimes that becomes an example of a native plant rescue, like you can always, just be realistic about it and be like, well, I would prefer not to spray Roundup along a waterway, which is that is the primary chemical that is used, created by Monsanto, one of the most egregious corporations on the planet, which I don't want to be friends with. And that is the main plant, the main chemical that's used because, like, the very fast little version that is not conspiracy theory, this is facts. And you can read about this in a PDF linked on one of my offerings for this. They were very instrumental in the creation of the national, panel on invasive plant species. Like, they drove this conversation very intentionally, to have a market for their chemical, for Roundup. And that's just facts. Like, you can look that up and you have to, it's like anything, follow the money, So yeah, there's some ecological considerations, but then there's the economic, and they are together. So sometimes you just got to be realistic and be like, well, okay, this is kind of painful and here it is. And like, maybe we can't, quote unquote, beat the knotweed, but can we move these plants somewhere else where they're no longer growing, but we know based on other indicator species, et cetera, that it's a place that could host these plants. And that's where it gets into understanding indicator species, understanding the native, the native plant landscape. So I've seen knotweed do it all. I've also seen knotweed bust up in parking lots and have bird nests in them and been like, that's awesome. So it's one of those plants that to me, like, when the world ends, quote, et cetera, like we'll have lots of knotweed and we'll have food, we'll have medicine, we'll have building materials. Like, it's like could do a lot with it. So it's going to be here. We're not going to beat knotweed. And that's the thing. And that's also the fool's errand with all of us. We're never going to beat knotweed. So what are we going to do? Just endlessly apply chemicals? Like, what is the end game? Like, yeah, we might need a different orientation.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. And so we're going to kind of close up, but I'm wondering if someone's kind of new to all this or new to understanding native, non-native, how do you encourage people to start kind of observing the land? Like just some very like practical, like, do I go out every day and observe? Do I write it down? Do it like what kinds of things do you do or tell people to just support them in starting to be curious and starting to learn?
Yeah, so I mean, a few things. Probably the most practical is like making a sit spot. So, a sit spot is just a little piece of land. It could be as big or small as you want, I mean, not super big, but somewhere where you can kind of see it in your view, and observe it throughout the seasons, but then even ideally years. And that's like a privilege I've had of living in Western Massachusetts for like 90% of my life. It's like I went out west for a while, did some traveling, but like I've lived in the Connecticut River Valley for most of my life. So I've gotten to observe. There's areas where I've been, harvesting nettles for like 20 years at least, and places I've been visiting even longer. So that is the benefit of the sit spot, is it helps start to coalesce and crystallize for you, like this larger plant time that I'm talking about. And watching the plants change and shift and grow, and what happens when the trees get bigger to the understory plants. And you can, a simple thing you can do with a sit spot that's great is to try to identify some of the plants in there. So that's one way. Another way I feel like is sort of a little bit deprogramming the language of invasive plants because it's a super it's a language of separation, you know, and it's like as soon as you think of a plant as invasive in your mind, like no one wants to be invaded. It literally is designed, honestly, I would argue that it is like by design that this word so powerful and strong was chosen because it elicits a stress response. It elicits a fear response. And then the response to that is, well, to fight, you want to fight, fight, freeze, but it elicits a stress response, you know? And people get into the fight with it. And so I would sort of like invite folks, if you're feeling super challenged by this conversation, to start to think about maybe what it might mean to shift some of your even like language around these plants, because that can be very powerful. One of my favorite reframe names for these plants comes from the indigenous scientist Jessica Hernandez, and I've got some of her work linked on one of the PDFs too. She calls these plants displaced plant relatives, and that just lands with like this softness for me that is so beautiful. And what I also love about it that we haven't like totally brought into the conversation yet is it brings like this animist lens to all of it. And like that's the lens, that's also a big part of where I'm coming from. Animism being like everything's imbued with spirit, you know, not just humans, but plants, but as well as things we might think inanimate, like a mountain or a stream or a river. And I will tell you that unfortunately, the invasive plant world is not ready for the animist perspective. I've tried, and you know, you get laughed away or whatever. But like, I don't care. You know, it's like fine. I don't know. Like, I'm gonna speak for the plants, like no matter where they're from. And you know, and so I think just shifting that language can be very, very helpful. And I think, you know, the final thing to really think about is like, you know, asking yourself, I guess this is, I'm sort of like speaking a little bit to like, I know the people that are going to be like really challenged, is like, if you're all the way to the extreme where you're like kind of feeling shut down by this and you're just like, no, like these plants should not be here, da da da, is like, I would honestly ask like, why you would hold hate in your heart for a plant. Like I would ask folks to maybe try to sit with that, because that's where this conversation goes really quickly and easily with people. Try hopping on a native plant group on Facebook and see how many people write about how much they hate certain plants, and that's the word that's used. And like that is so painful to me. And herbalism is pretty inherently animist, you know, anyway. Like we like the science and the spirit, you know, that's like most of us. And it's just like ask yourself why and how that is like, is that facilitating your connection to the land and to nature, or is that putting a direct, you know, sort of cut in it? And you know, I think you probably all know what I think. But to me, it's one of the biggest ways you can open yourself up and be in relationship to the land and listen to the land and observe, like we're talking about, as opposed to positioning yourself as an expert in where a plant should or shouldn't be. Like, you know, we might not know what plant migration looks like. It right now, in an age of climate chaos, we're in a mass extinction event globally. We don't know what biodiversity looks like under these conditions, and it may be very painful. I can acknowledge that it could be very painful to watch a stand of native plants that you really love change. I understand that, and that may be where you bring in manual control or you know things like that or plant rescues. But I think the minute that we take it to a level where we're literally cutting down that bittersweet and telling everybody how much we hate it, that I feel like is crossing a line where we've kind of lost the thread. We've lost, you know, we've lost the plot. So, so that would be, you know, sort of my invitation if this conversation is challenging. And if it's not, you know, maybe we can all do a little bit to advocate for all the plants. When as best we can.
It's so important. And I was telling you earlier, like, this talk is towards the end of the series, and I almost want to put it at the beginning now because it's such a great Just a deep way of really shifting the perspective, or an invitation to, really be curious. And, we're talking about connecting with plants. Are we talking, excuse me, only about connecting with certain plants, or like the ones we choose, the ones we deem are worthy? And like, thinking about that, and if that's the case, and really opening up. And I love the examples that you gave. So displaced plant relatives. I love that you brought that forward. I know in the garden, sometimes when I'm working with people, I talk about like the plant behavior, wherever it's from. But if something is spreads a lot, I say it's kind of spready, it has that behavior. So look out and be aware. And yeah, so thank you so much, Jade, for this conversation. We could keep talking, and it's such a deep, rich conversation. But I'm so glad that we were able to have you on the show, and just thank you so much for being here and for sharing all your knowledge and yourself with us.
Thank you, Lauren. Thanks for being open to, letting me talk about it, because I know it's controversial, but I think it's great to have the conversation. So without,
Absolutely.
someone yelling at me. So thank you for being open.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome. And thank you to all our viewers and listeners. And we will see you soon. Bye.
Yeah, thank you. Bye.